Oh, yeah, because usually we get rewarded for doing that. I mean, professionally, if you do something very well, then you're like, that's it. I don't have to stretch myself. But to me, it's in the stretching and learning something new that you get new learning, you get new options, you get new perspectives.
Hello and welcome to our program, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we talk to business people, journalists, professors, ambassadors, leaders and luminaries from all over the world. My name is Siebe van der Zee, and I'm your host. I'm originally from the Netherlands, happily residing in the beautiful Grand Canyon state of Arizona. I'm also known as the Dutchman in the desert. I hope you will enjoy our program. Our guest today is Professor Dennis LeClaire. Dennis LeClaire is Professor of Cross-Cultural Communications and Global Negotiations at the Thunderbird School of Global Management at Arizona State University. A native of Normandy in France, Dennis received his doctorate in cross-cultural communications from the Hugh Downs School of Communication at Arizona State University. At the Thunderbird School of Global Management, Dennis teaches multiple programs, including an on-campus MBA class, an executive MBA program, and a customized corporate program for major companies such as Raytheon, Novartis, and Medtronic. Dennis has been published in leading journals, and he is also active as a business consultant in North America and in France. He is a sought-after keynote speaker and seminar leader for organizations such as American Express, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, ExxonMobil, and others on topics like cultural misunderstanding, improving multicultural awareness, and cultural strategic negotiation preparation. That's a mouthful. You can learn more about Professor LeClaire on our website, 10lessonslearned.com. Bonjour, Dennis. Comment ça va? Thank you for joining us.
Bonjour, bonjour. Ça va très bien, et toi?
Well, nous pouvons parler en français. I suggest we don't speak French, but it's very nice to have you as our guest, global communicator, professor. Wonderful. When we talk about cross-cultural communications, what would be the definition? How would you describe that field, because it seems to cover so much?
You know, actually, it's a very good question. To my definition of cross-cultural communication, might be different if you go and talk to other professors, but it's really our ability using communication to close the gap, close the differences we have, because we have way more in common than we have differences. So to me, what I try to remind people when we do cross-cultural communication is actually the ability we have of finding common grounds, common knowledge, common experiences with other people. So that would be my definition.
Well, it covers literally a lot of ground. This is global. It's international. Is it also domestic within countries?
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, it's also like, you know, if you take countries like, you know, the US, for example, that, you know, you have people from the West Coast are very different from people from the East, you know, North and South. I mean, you always have people in the South of France are very different from the North of France. People in the South of the Netherlands are different from the people in the North of the Netherlands. I learned that, you know, going to a store one time, it's like, really? And they're like, oh, no. You use an expression that is only used in the South of the Netherlands. So, you know, there's always disparity that way.
Very true. Yeah. Is there perhaps a lesson that you have learned in your life, in your international life, that you would like to teach yourself if you would be 30 years old today?
To be more patient, to be more patient, to observe, to not be the one talking all the time. I think in my 30s, I was trying to show off like who I was and kind of what I knew. And I think that's, you know, listen to people is way more interesting.
There's wisdom in that, no doubt. At the same time, as a professor, as a business consultant, you are asked to communicate and share your thoughts and wisdom. Not to put you on the spot, but how do you combine that with listening?
Oh, no, actually, I think it's super important because, like, for example, if you look at, if you listen to like doing consulting in businesses, it's all about listening. I mean, if you coach somebody, it's you listening to them and, you know, asking them the right questions, you can get down to what their real issue is. And if you just come up and say, I'm going to tell you how to do it, it's not as interesting. I mean, my teaching, for example, now, if I look at how I decide to teach 20 years ago, 25 years ago, compared to how I teach now, my role is to be the one who speaks the least amount during my classes. I present a concept, then I have the students talking to each other, and we come back and see what they have learned. And that's the way I love the courses to go. Super interactive, super engaged from the students. And I try, unfortunately, sometimes you have to present big concepts. So I have to be the one speaking, yeah. But it's just, you know, let them go and, you know, just, I'm just presenting frameworks as a professor. That, hey, have you thought about doing this, that perspective? That to me is my true job as an educator.
You see, I think that's a very important point because many of us, myself included, have a tendency to speak too much. And yes, over time, I think I have learned how to turn that off or turn it down and to focus more on the listening part. And I think that's an important element of wisdom that indeed you learn over time. It may be more difficult for people earlier in their career to say, you know what, I'm just going to listen and find out. But it's an important tool if they can apply it.
And I'm not saying I'm the best at it either. I'm just saying that's what you asked me for my lessons. Like,
yeah, no,
working on. I'm still working because, you know, there's sometimes I finish a lecture or whatever. And I'm like, well, that was not good. I mean, basically, yeah, you talk the whole time. So that's still something that this is my self-awareness. I have to keep up, actually.
No, I like it. I like it.
I have, and other days, it just totally escapes me.
Well, and obviously, we're going to listen to your 10 lessons. So please speak up. Let's start with lesson number one. Learn something new every day, even if it's a new word. Literally every day?
Oh, yeah. Every day. I love, like the other day, I love to find new words. I don't know the words. Like I listen to a French podcast like every day. But there was a word in French. I had no idea where the origin was from. And it was just like, and sometimes because English is not my first language. So sometimes I will hear a word in English and I'm just like, I have never heard of that word. I mean, where does it come from? And to me, that's language is absolutely amazing. So to me, the linguistic part of it, but it's also, I love cooking. So I learn every day how to cook something. I love pastry. So I just make cakes and stuff. And, you know, one time I wanted to know how to make sausage. So with a friend, we made sausage for like 3 weekends in a row. And just, I like to be able to learn something new, like listen to a podcast I've never heard of before, but I tried to learn an instrument. It was not a good experience. I can say this is not in my cards. You know, you realize sometimes you learn and you realize, no, do something else. But I think it's important for all of us.
And in that sense, to have an open mind, but also to have somewhat of a focus to force yourself to continue to learn, right? Yeah. That's part of what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, for example, at the school, I mean, where I am right now, my professional environment, there has been major shifts in one of the area of that the school is really big on is on the space industry. I don't know anything about the space industry. So right now I'm working on like, what can I, you know, it's absolutely fascinating field. But I'm learning. I'm trying to learn something every day about the space industry that I didn't know before. So it's a kind of keep learning.
I like it. Yeah, it's inspiring, right? To keep looking for new things and try new things, et cetera, et cetera. We tend to get stuck sometimes in doing the same thing over and over.
Oh, yeah, because usually we get rewarded for doing that. I mean, professionally, if you do something very well, then you're like, that's it. I don't have to stretch myself. But to me, it's in the stretching and learning something new that you get new learning, you get new options, you get new perspective. So, that's the part.
Lesson number two is something that you don't want to do. Never stay angry. Anger will eat you alive.
No, that's something I've learned. I was always very angry when I was growing up. And I just learned that at some point you have to let it go. You know, it's just like, and it's angry. Yeah, it's being angry. I mean, you know, I was 17 and I had a bleeding ulcer just because I was just mad at people and mad at everything and be able to control that and focus that. And so I told myself, you know, at some point it's like, I have to let it go. You know, it's just, there is no need for doing that. I mean, that anger is not going to be serving you well. It's not serving people around you anyway. And, you know, you need to, it goes to, you know, it's just like, yeah, just let it go. The anger is like the physical anger, I mean, I used to play squash a lot when I was growing up. I couldn't tell you how many brackets I broke playing. I used to have to play with a teeth protection because that was my fuel. And then one time I was just like, no, you have to quiet down. And it was so much better. But it's the physical, it's also the mental aspect of not being angry. Let it go.
Yeah. Well, in a way, two questions. But the first one, was there a moment that you decided to do it differently? And the other point, there is so much going on around the world that angers people.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, when a war is going on,
mm-hmm.
the devastation, when other things are happening, and you see it, of course, in politics, mm-hmm. the anger. Is that something that you would say, don't worry about it? Or how do you express your thoughts when you are in disagreement?
So, you know, I read, and I do not remember, a sociologist that basically, they did research on Facebook and networks and friends and all that. And you realize that in your life, I mean, the maximum amount of people you can talk to, like really have conversations, 50 people. And so, you know, most of us, if we say we have like 10 friends, like close friends, that's huge. I mean, people you can call, that 10 friends is amazing.
Yeah.
So to me, the anger is just like, there's a lot of stuff going on I don't like, but do I have control over it? It's like, no. So I try to help people who are close to me and close to people I know or locally. That's just like, you know, it angers me to see what's going on in the US, it angers me what's happening in Ukraine, it angers me to see what's happening in a lot of countries, but I don't feel that I can have an impact unless, you know, yes, you can vote, you can give money, you can make donations, but there's like reading the newspaper. I mean, I used to read newspapers all the time. I stopped doing it. It's just like, it puts your mind in the morning at such a, it's just like not good.
Yeah.
I just can't deal with it.
I think we could use people in leadership with that attitude, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Hopefully, yes. But, anger fuels people, though. That's the thing. And, you know, you ask me, is there a time? It's just, to me, it's just like, I realize it's exhausting. It is absolutely exhausting to be angry all the time. It's, you know, it eats you alive. I mean, it does. And to me, it's just like, you have to find another way. I mean, I don't want to spend 50 years in my 10 lessons, you know, having a list of people I'm angry. You know, I want to do something else with my life.
I hear what you're saying, and it kind of feeds into your lesson number three. Yeah. Stress is like, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can.
And this is one of my favorite quotes from Arthur Ashe. Yeah, and it was interesting because to me, I mean, if you look at why we get stressed sometimes, it's because I think there's sometimes a disconnect between understanding, kind of, we know where we're studying, but we forget to use what we have. I mean, we are never going to have everything. We are never going to have everybody we want to. And you just do what you can. Just put one foot forward and just make it happen. And managing stress, I mean, it goes back to my second lessons because it's a different, I mean, I'm not angry anymore. But I'm still working on managing the stress because stress will, and sometimes it's just like being able to stop and doing it. I mean, I gave myself a gift when I turned 50 and I got my training in transcendental meditation. And it was just the most amazing, like within 2 weeks, it was like, I don't know how to explain it because I've done yoga in the past. I've done a lot of. But doing that meditation really was just this amazing level. I mean, I don't know, your brain just like you manage the stress very differently. And sometimes I forget to do my meditation because I get busy. But when I have time just sitting quietly for like 20 minutes, even once a day, just really allows you to manage your stress. I mean, so that's one of my lessons. And, you know, it's just like being able to really manage that. Is very important. They have done research on meditation, managing stress in school system where, you know, we are all buzzing. We're all buzzing all the time. And I think the technology has added to that. I mean, I'm not on Facebook anymore. My Facebook account got hacked and at first I'm like, whoa. And now I'm like, oh, okay, good. That's good. You know, but now it's just like one thing I don't have to worry about it. So, you know, the only thing I'm on is LinkedIn. That's it.
There is life without Facebook.
But yeah, managing stress is critical.
Lesson number four, Dennis, is one that I like a lot, and it depends again on the context, but I'm thinking of you, of course, as professor in cross-cultural communications and global negotiation. Lesson number four, don't judge people too fast. We have more in common than we are different.
Well, no, it's to me so important, the cross-cultural element, because we really quickly turn the judgment wheel, because we spin all the time, because we are always like, you know, trying to outsmart people, show how we're smart. And yeah, sometimes just like, you know, just let's turn off that judgment, you know, screen, but it's very hard. And, you know, unfortunately, the US, for what has happened for the last few years, it's very hard to not do it, but it's like, we have more in common than we're different. And I have experienced that traveling around the world of finding myself in weird situation where it's just like, hey, I don't know how to do it. And people say, well, do you need some help? And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, it's just like, that's the part to me that I find interesting. When you start to really talk to people, you realize, oh yeah, we have more in common. I mean, you know, it's just like, yeah, language is a barrier. You know, language is a barrier, but I learned something. One of my students one time showed me, because he said, I've never learned a language. He spoke two languages. He said, I speak English and Spanish, that's all. He said, but I've gone around the world. I said, how do you do it? He said, but he had a gift, and the gift was to be able to draw. And so his travel books were just drawings everywhere. And he said, it's just amazing to show people that we have way more in common about drawing and art and all that stuff. But again, it's a lesson. I hope I'm good, but it's like not to go to the judgment value.
It's like I said, this is one of my favorite topics, having lived and worked in different countries. As of course, you know, I'm thinking of Edward T. Hall, 1976, the iceberg theory. You think of an iceberg where the tip sticks out from the water, but the biggest part is below the sea line, the water line. And at the bottom of the iceberg, values, and a little bit above the values, beliefs, belief systems. And above the waterline, visible, are the behaviors. And I think we both know how quick people are to put labels on behavior, cultural differences, and typically they can be negative because it's different than our culture, whatever our culture is. It's different.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, to me, it happens every time I go back to France, because I've been in the US now for 30 years. I'm American. So going back to France, I speak the language. I don't know if I look like people anymore, but you know, you see what I mean? It's like, I fit, because, you know, the first couple of days I speak French and that, oh, you have a weird accent. And then a couple of days, then it's kind of my accent relaxes and I'm not looking for my words all the time. But I remember like being very frustrated at first, going back to my native country and judging what people were doing and how they were doing, you know, like the fact that in France, you have lunch at noon. You don't have lunch at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, it doesn't happen. You know, you have dinner at 8 o'clock. There's a pace of life. And it always, I remember like going back to France and judging, you know, like, why are the stores not open on Sundays? And you're just like, and you realize, you know, you're losing money. And then you're like, no, it's actually good that the stores are not open on Sundays. You know, it's just like, but it's just even from my home, you know, birth country, basically, I judged what was going on very quickly. And I've learned to just like turn it off, like very quickly.
But it's human nature. I think
absolutely.
It's fair, right? And I think that's something we have to expect from human beings, all of us, to compare situations, like you said, lunch. When I lived in South America, the restaurants would not open until 9 p.m. in the evening. I couldn't change the country, even though I was hungry.
It's really the part. It's really the part to me of that judgment. And then you can just look around, not judge your neighbors. I mean, but it's hard. I love that exercise of doing the lessons, because to me, it's almost an exercise of self-awareness. I mean, how self-aware are you of sometimes the blinders you put on yourself, or you know, you believe you know how to do things. So I truly enjoy just going through these 10 lessons because I was like, man, I don't know if I remember, I told you, I don't know if I have 10 lessons. And then after one, it's like, well, that's a very interesting exercise. So,
yeah, no, this is, by the way, this is something we hear from many of our guests. They enjoy the exercise to come up with the 10 lessons. And I want to, on this particular topic, because again, it intrigues me so much as well in the academic sphere, when we talk about high context versus low context cultures. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you can give a quick overview of the difference between what is high context, what is low context, when it comes to cultures and countries, et cetera.
It's a good point. I mean, like the high context countries are, and it's linguistic also, like for example, the countries like in Asia, like Japan and Korea, the Middle East are very high context, which is the context where the communication is taking place. It's very important. Everything is happening contextual. Low context are usually the Northern European countries are much more low context, which is like all the information are given in the language. They are given like very clearly stated, and it's the language structure where you have very quickly a verb, you know, a subject, verb, complement. It's a very clear sentences. And, you know, to give you an idea of difference between high context and low context, high context, you know, in Japan, if you ask somebody, Japanese, I remember when we had a Japanese guest who stayed with us and you ask his opinion, and always his expression was always like,
yes,
very difficult. And you realize he has given you all the information. That's the high context communication. A low context, I could ask the Dutch or French person, what do you think? And okay, what I think is like, it's stupid. And I will tell you how it should be done. You know,
you are so right.
Yeah. That's the low context way of communicating. And so that's the big difference. And so the not judging people, and it goes to a lot of things like, you know, high context, low context, but extrovert, introvert. I mean, that's, when I talk about not judging people too fast is also the ability of not always judging people who are extrovert as being the people who know best. I've seen a lot of people who are very introvert, but when you start talking to them, you realize, whoa, you are paying attention or you aren't really super engaged. It's like, it's not the engagement that you have in class. I mean, that's why I love being an educator. Because you can look at the students who are raise their hands, who participate all the time, but you always have quiet students. And when they come to your office, you have conversation with them and you're like, wow, that is so interesting. I'm so glad you came and talked to me because I absolutely changed my perception of who you are and how you engage. So I try to have the students coming to my office hours, like all the students, at least for 10, 15 minutes, just so I can change my perception of who they are in class and kind of like, because they have so much talent and they have so much knowledge that a classroom is not, it's a way of judging students by grades or whatever. So, you know, it's a different way of doing it. So.
It's such an important issue. And I think you and I can fill a complete hour on that part, because it's part of who we are as human beings that we make those judgments, but we have to become aware and do a better understanding in order to really understand what is happening and not to be so quickly in making a judgment. Lesson number five.
Yeah.
It's almost Dutch, low context, travel.
Absolutely.
Travel.
Yeah, because to me, it's just like, you don't know who you are until you have started to cross your own borders. I mean, you know, like if you take the example of like, you know, Netherlands or France or the US, you can travel in the US, but you are still, there's still a certain underlying value and culture that unless you cross the borders, then you realize, oh, that's who it means to be me, basically. And that to me is the part of travel. It's not, it's yes, the food, but it's also the ability of traveling. I love airports. I know it sounds like a totally like weird things, but I love airports because especially big international airports, because you realize they are this weird space where you have people coming from all over the world. People are at very high level of stress because it's to them, they don't see the airport as being the journey. They are like, it's unfortunate, I'm stuck here. And so you have a lot of stress. You have behaviors that you might not see otherwise. You have places where you can pray. You have people who are under amazing distress. And then you have people who travel a lot and they look at an airport. And I remember talking to a friend of mine one time and we're talking about Heathrow Airport. And I was going through Heathrow so much that I was able to leave my seat on the airplane and be in the lounge in less than 20 minutes. Then we talk about like, how stupid of a record is that? You know, it's just like, you know, because yeah, the new the day, you know, you see what I mean? It's just like, and then you're just like, yeah, but it's like, is that really something you should be proud of? That you, because to me, the airport was just like just a one stop going somewhere else. And so I've learned, like, I was in Oman. I have never been to Oman. So I walked the airport like 2 or 3 times just to see people, just because it's just like to see where people are from, you know, the stress level. And to me, that's the part of traveling on every other, and the destination, of course. But, you know, just like the airport, I always pay attention to the airport because it's not only the business lounge. There's something, something that is interesting in there.
I've never heard anyone talk with such passion about being at an airport, but I understand.
I know, that's what I'm saying. You know, no, I'm talking about big international airports. I'm sorry. Let me clarify that, you know.
I understand. And I understand the reason why. I had never really thought about it myself that indeed, when you're at the airport, and let's say we see that a lot when you're stuck at the airport, right? With long delays and lots of people. But to your point, if you're dealing with an international airport, you get people from all over the world in a very small place. And yes, they're dealing with stress. Traveling can be stressful, but you make a great point. And of course, the other element of travel is experiencing behavior and situations that are different from what you are used to.
And it, you know, and to me, this is, to me, airports, and to me, I'm sorry to go back to the airport issue, but it's the first and the last thing people will see from your home country. And I remember getting into, I realized I had to turn off my, like, I had to shut up because I was at the Chicago airport and the TSA agent was yelling at people to move lane. And I look at her, it's like, yelling is not going to be helpful. She obviously does not understand you. And yelling is not going to be helpful. I say, and I look at the person, and do you realize this is the last thing that that person is going to remember is to be yelled by a TSA agent?
Yeah.
She might have had the best time. And then her negative is that part here. I said, just, you know, just come on, recognize that she can't, she's not understanding. And, but I love also, I mean, you know, outside when you're at the airport, I love everything about traveling in a foreign country. But to me, just like that experience should not be overstated because I've seen so many things.
Oh, absolutely. And it's something that, you know, I know from experience has been happening for a long time that if someone needs to communicate with someone who doesn't speak the language fluently, whichever language, but let's say English, sometimes people start talking louder.
Yeah.
To the point where they start yelling. And of course, if you don't understand the language, it doesn't help.
It doesn't help at all. It's not useful at all. If you travel, it's, to me, it's just like, yeah, it will teach you so much about who you are. It will show you so much about the stress. Yeah, and I've been very lucky. I mean, I've traveled professionally for Thunderbird for like 18 years. So they send me all over the world. I've gone to Russia many times. I've gone to Saudi Arabia many times. I've gone to places that Portugal, Hong Kong, Singapore, Brazil. I mean, I've gone to some neat places. And you always learn Mexico, of course, but Canada. But, you know, it's just like you learn so much about like how to deal with other people. And
in combination with your earlier lesson, you continue to learn, right? It's not to say I've been around the world, so now I know it.
Yeah.
There's no way you can learn at all.
No, like for example, like, you know, I was just in Saudi Arabia and I, even though I have, you know, I consider myself a seasoned traveler, I got, you know, there's 2 types of cabs in Saudi Arabia and I took the wrong cab. So it was like, oh, but I should have paid attention.
What happened?
When you go outside the airport in Riyadh, you have the state owned cabs that have a fixed price. And then you have, it's not even Uber, it's just like people with their cars and they have a sign on top, it says taxi. And they say, where do you want to go? And then they charge you whatever.
They charge you a little bit more.
Yeah. And that's what happened to me. I'm like, okay, what's the exchange rate? It's like, oh, it's $30. Okay, fine. I can give him $30. But he was, you know, these kind of things, like not paying attention, you know, but I was exhausted. I mean, after all the travel, but I, you know, I've had also great experiences.
Sounds good. We're talking today with Dennis LeClaire, professor of cross-cultural communications at the Thunderbird School of Global Management, sharing his 10 lessons he learned in his life, in his career. Lesson number 6, success is a journey. not the final destination. Well, we're talking about traveling, and now we're talking about success is a journey, not a final destination.
I realized that when I was trying to do my PhD, because people were trying to crank their PhD in 4 years. I mean, it was kind of like, and to me, I'm like, I'm not in a hurry. So I took courses that were not maybe part of my PhD program. I was very slow. Not that I'm a slow learner, but I realized I really love to learn. So to me, it was just like, well, there's a chance for me to kind of like, that journey is way more interesting because that's where you learn who you are, what you do. And so then when I got my PhD, I tried to go for tenure, which I hated every day of the whole process, every day, because I did not enjoy the journey. I thought the journey was painful. Nothing was interesting about the whole journey. But I think sometimes in life, we think that the destination is what matters, but actually, no, it's the journey. I mean, you know, what I hate to use sports analogy is like, I've run marathon in my life. I mean, I'm in really bad shape. I couldn't do it now, but you know, realize that the marathon is a great mind trick and mind trip, because the first, if any of your listeners have ever run a marathon, you will see that very quickly you realize those last 7 miles are the most important one. The first 20 are just like easy compared to the last six, because your mind starts to trick you. And that's where the journey really starts in the marathon. That's where you are just questioning, you know, if you can do it, if you are going to be able to finish, if you're collapsing, your body's going to tell you can't fit, you can't run. And that to me, and then when you are at the final destination, you're like, oh, wow, I really enjoyed the last six. It was really tough, but you realize that is a closure. But what was important is like all the 26 miles you run before that were very interesting. So that, and I try to remind me of that because I have a business. We had a business that we are just closing right now. And the success was the journey of having the business. And so I'm writing a book on entrepreneurial journey, because that's really what matters. It's the destination is like, yeah, you know, it's interesting, but if you plan everything, you know, destination is not surprising.
How would you define your greatest success in life? That can be a very tough question, or at least tough one to answer.
I think finishing my PhD, because I did it in a foreign language and it just, and in French, and I'm not a great writer, and be able to do it was to me, yeah, that was pretty amazing. And I have a PhD in a foreign language, and you know, for some people it's just like not a big deal. To me, it's like, that's pretty amazing, you know, because if I could see my French teacher in high school told me I couldn't write any words correctly, and you know, showing her I could publish in English, I think that to me would be a great success professionally. Yeah.
And I asked out of nowhere, of course, and I realized it's a tough question to answer, but I appreciate your answer because it has to do with something that happened a few years ago.
Yeah.
Right. Like you said, getting a PhD is remarkable in itself.
Yeah.
But to be successful with a PhD in a foreign country, that adds to it.
Yeah. It just sometimes, you know, it's something I kind of, you know, because I'm the only one in my family who has a higher education. I mean, I take that for granted.
Yeah.
And you realize, oh man, no. They look at me differently to me. And just like, no, you know, it's just like, so yeah, I would say professional, I would say that's, you know, but then when you're surrounded by other PhDs, then people start to say, well, how many publications do you have? Like, where have you published? But to me, that part here is like, yeah, no, it was really good. I mean, I'm very proud of that.
Yeah. And I think it makes sense in that sense with the question, because you're still active, you're still doing all kinds of stuff. Yeah. So it's not the end of the destination, but it was a moment in time that you look back at and say, yeah, that was success. I achieved something at that moment. I guess if you win, you know, gold medal for winning the marathon, that would have been something.
No, it's the same thing. It, you know, it's the achievement. You realize what goes to be able to that final destination. That's the part just like, no, that was pretty, that was a very good question, actually.
Well, I appreciate it. It's great.
Yeah.
I enjoyed our conversation. Lesson number 7, learn to cultivate creativity. And my mind is a little bit spinning about that as far as how do you do that?
So this is where, you know, you go back to like the the wounds that you get when you're in high school. But my high school where I went to was super competitive. I mean, there was super, super, super competitive. I mean, I don't know how to explain that to people other than when we got our grades every month, basically the director of the school came, and if you were in the lower five, he just threw your grade cards on the floor and tell you you're wasting money. Yeah. So it was just like, so you never wanted to be the last bottom five who had to pick up your grades from the floor and say, you know, you go to your parents because you're wasting their money, basically. But so there was not enough creativity in the school because we're all like academic and all that stuff. And I've learned, I love going to museums. I love, like, you know, you put me anywhere like in a museum and I could be there for 4 hours. And I'm just, because I just find the power of creativity, like music, anybody who has a skill that is super creative. It could be painters, musicians, people who cook, people who draw, anything to me, I just find it interesting. And cultivating creativity, I'm a pretty good baker, and I realize I love baking because it's a very creative process for me and it's very stressless. I can make my cakes, I can do whatever, you know, and I make cakes like at least once or two every week, but I don't eat them. I mean, I eat some parts of it, but like for example, in the garden right now, we have a big fig tree. So I made a fig tart, but that's my second one I've made in a couple of days, but we try to give them to the neighbors. So that to me is my creativity. I've always liked welding. So I tried to give myself some time for welding. I've welded gates. I think it's important for people to have another outlet than their jobs. You know, something has nothing to do with physical. So it cannot be like physical activities either, but it's just something that where your brain is totally engrossed. You're in flow, basically. It's something you are doing that is not your job. Like musicians are getting flow all the time, where that creativity is really part of who they are. It's like more like something that you do, you know, even if it's like a project or something where you have to use different skills, different part of your brains, basically. You know, you believe that you have like two parts of your brain and, you know, be able to balance these two here, because I think it makes either side very much more interesting. That's why mathematicians are interesting, but they have a creative outlet. You know, that to me is very important. If people don't have one, they try something.
No, interesting. But lesson number 8, help and support others. Sounds really good. Where did that lesson come from in your case?
Because people helped me. Because when I came to the US, I didn't know anybody. I had a grant from my sister had given me money, and Americans helped me. I mean, you know, finding an apartment, that part of helping where you are in a foreign country and you don't know anything. I remember my first computer, my advisor bought the computer for me and I paid him every month. He didn't have to do that. It was not his problem, you know? And so I think it's like receiving the help from Americans in general and see how generous people were, that to me, I'm like, you know, helping. I mean, so helping.
And then giving back.
Yeah, give back. I mean, you know, I've been really blessed to be helped in my life, that, you know, I try to help other people and support them, and just as much as I can. I mean, and sometimes it's money, sometimes it's time, whatever it is. So, but that to me is very important, because I know that I would not have done what I've done in the US if I had not been helped.
Yeah, interesting that I can understand if you look at how you have been helped, that you want to give back because you know how important it is to help people. It's a fairly simple concept, right?
I'm not a very religious person, so it's not linked to any other religious belief. It's just like some people need some help without an exchange of anything. They just need help.
That's an important element in there.
That there is not like, you know, not having an exchange of anything. And again, this is kind of the inspiration of helping and support people, but sometimes we're good, sometimes we're bad.
Yeah.
You know, it's the ability we have of reminding ourselves of that. I mean, especially for me, it's important. Yeah.
Makes sense. Lesson number 9, learn to slow down. And I wish I would say, yes, that's what I do, but please explain.
Yeah, no, it's just like, especially right now where we have access to, like, and I love technology. I love WhatsApp. I love texting. I mean, I tell my students, if you have to talk to me, just send me a text or WhatsApp. Don't send me an email. I'm going to check my email, but I read so many emails during the day, and then I'm just going to be like, oh yes, somebody asked me a question 2 days ago, so I have to create a list for it. So, but at the same time, that creates, it goes back to like, it creates a lot of stress. It creates a lot of things where, and we can all function at a very high level, but something is very good for us to learn to slow down. Like, for example, you know, when I go to France, what I love about going to France is the fact that we have 9 hours difference. And so my phone is on for my family. They want to reach out to me, but I will turn off my phone in France at 7 o'clock. Because to me, it's just like, I am on vacation to be able to disconnect. I'm trying to slow down. I'm not trying to keep my daily job or my daily output or inputs, but I'm pretty good. I think I'm pretty good at slowing down. I mean, that's one aspect of COVID. I mean, it's just like, I am very lucky. We have a great house and I realized, you know, I don't have to go anywhere. It's just like weeks without seeing anybody. And we had all the food we needed. And it's just like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, I have my dogs, the chickens and the yard to take care of. And you realize, oh, you know, it's, you know, slowing down is a good thing.
Now, if I think of however we describe it, but up and coming professionals, people with great ambition early in their career, would you tell them to slow down?
I would tell them to pay attention to their mental capacity to absorb what they think is moving around, like, you know, getting information, because I like the fact that in France or in Europe, people get their 5 weeks paid vacation. They get all that part and people look at it, it costs a lot of money, but it's also, it forces people to slow down. I mean, people to just like disconnect from the world. I mean, Mercedes-Benz, I learned that from their high-level executives, their email system shuts down on weekend. And the reason why, because they have done studies that actually we don't have the capacity to always be on. So for these young people, yeah, you can try to do it, but you're going to burn out. And so be very judicious of basically understanding that sometimes you just need to take a break. And when I need to take a break, I need, don't go online and don't slow down, basically. And how you make decision, that's something I've learned. Like in terms of learning to slow down, I try to not make decision like on the spot. I always say, well, let me think about it. And because it allows me to slow down and kind of pay attention to what's happening.
There has to be a balance.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes you need to move fast, but I am not sure that moving fast is always the best way.
No, and it's a good point. I think common sense tells people that you have to take a break from time to time, even when you're busy and you have, you know, working under pressure, you do have to allow yourself, because it's not going to work in your favor if you do not give yourself a break.
Yeah. And then, like, for example, I love to take naps, because you reach a point where you're, you know, if you really work intensely on a lot of things, I like to take like a 40-minute nap. Because you need to give your brain time to just like shut down for a while. And your brain is still working, because you come back and you have to really refresh. I mean, but again, I'm very lucky. I'm very blessed because I have a job where I can basically pace myself during the day any way I want to. And I know a lot of the listeners don't have that luxury, but I do. And I try to not forget about it.
Well, and perhaps, Dennis, in your case, you're dealing with communication in so many different countries with different time zones. So yeah, it may be whatever in the afternoon where you're at, and it's going to be morning somewhere else. Or
yeah, no, oh yeah, and I like, you know, I for example, I am the king of falling asleep in airplanes. I've fallen asleep on airplanes between Phoenix and Los Angeles, like an hour and a half. I'm asleep. I get on the plane. I'm asleep on the plane, and I get up when we land in Los Angeles, and I look around, and you know, people are like, it's just like, yeah, my wife doesn't. She likes to travel with me, but she finds it so annoying because I get in an airplane and I'm asleep so fast. I don't know if it's the movement of the airplane or something. It just, I'm like a baby in a car. You know, I just fall asleep so fast.
But
so.
Then you arrive at Los Angeles International Airport, and that's the center of the universe, as you explained.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
So that's a good combination.
Yeah.
Well, we are at lesson number 10. Learn how to become a better mentor. And I have some thoughts, some questions, but please go ahead and your thoughts.
So again, because professionally, I'm an educator at the core. So when people ask me, what do? I always say that I'm an educator. Just happen to have a PhD. I know a few things, but I'm just an educator at the core. And I've learned that being a mentor to people is super rewarding, but not everybody is ready to be a mentor. And being a mentor requires you to, you have to slow down, to listen to the person you are trying to work with. Yeah. Somebody you are trying to help, because you cannot say, oh, I have the solution for you. Because then you are not a mentor. You are just putting your framework, your lenses, your way of looking at the world in a way that is not what the person needs. So I hope I do that correctly at the school. But yeah, to me, that's, and a mentor that, you know, I have an expression, is like, you meet people for a reason, a season, or a lifetime. And sometimes you could just meet somebody for, like, you know, a couple of weeks and that's it, you're done. You know, they needed you for that one thing. And, you know, season could be a semester, you know, and a lifetime, it could be friends you have for life. So that's the part of, and again, I'm not saying I'm really good at it. I'm just saying it's one of my lessons that, you know, I love to be known as a mentor, but it's just, you know, sometimes it's that capacity of self-awareness.
Well, as a professor, educator, teacher, it fits well with serving as a mentor. Just curious, do you currently have a mentor yourself?
No, that's a good question. But I've had people and have admired. My first professor, and when I came to the US, was an amazing mentor. I'm sure he did, you know, unfortunately he passed away a few years ago. He knew he was an amazing mentor because he had a way, like, he's the one who bought my first computer. You know, but he was not from the US, he was from Ghana, and he understood kind of the struggle of international student. And so he had that ability to be a mentor. Yeah, it was just really an amazing relationship that we had. And I could never use his first name. Even after I got my PhD, it's like, no, it's still Dr. Tay, it's not Victor. I mean, I could use his first name around other people, but to me, it's just like, no, that's the part of, like, the mentor mentee. It was just like, he did impact my life. But right now, no, I don't.
Dennis, it's great to have this conversation and talking about your 10 lessons. And it makes me think about, are there any lessons that you have unlearned in your life, in your career?
From the 10 I just gave you?
No, just, it could be, but it could be in just in life that you thought, I got to do this differently. You did touch on that during your 10 lessons, but there may be another one that stands out.
To unlearn, you know, I'm not kidding. That question is really puzzling. But to me, it's like, so it's something I used to do that I'm not doing anymore.
Exactly.
And like, you know, I don't want to use the word aggressive, but it goes to that anger issues. Like, always wanted to be, because, you know, you asked a question earlier about, like, early in your career. And that part, it's a learn, you have to learn to be, like, number one, number two, number three.
Yeah.
Then that's something you have to unlearn, actually, as you move up in an organization, because that part maybe is the lesson I had to unlearn. It's like, I had to unlearn to be that competitive. You know, you talk earlier about the mentor. I remember having somebody watch me teach one time, and he gave me the best lesson ever, because I was teaching and I was like, man, I'm good. I was thinking that I'm really good. And at the end, he came to me and said, and somebody I respected also, because he had been doing it. Well, he was one of your professors at Thunderbird, actually. And so basically he talked to me and said, you know what? People know you are smart, but it's not about you. It's about them. And I'm like, and that was just like, it was like such a light bulb, because you realize that's what being to me in my role as an educator, that's what it is. It's not about me. It's about the students. And that shift, I had to unlearn it. So that's a lesson that, because you get a PhD, it's all about you. A PhD is the most selfish degree people will ever get, because it's all about you. If you are the one who works, you know, it's all, the PhD is it's super selfish as a degree. But then if you really want to educate and engage people, you have to unlearn the fact it's not about you, because by the time you have a PhD, everybody, okay, you have a stamp of approval that you know something, and then you have to unlearn being selfish with your knowledge and be able to listen to people. So maybe that's a lesson.
I think it's a very, very important point that you're raising. You were just talking about your biggest success was obtaining or achieving the PhD.
Yeah.
And what you're sharing now is to say, hey, it's not about me. It's about my students.
And that part was just, but it's, which I remember when he told me that, because I was just trying to go through all the material and it's like, you know, it's, people know you're smart, just shut up and listen to them. And we're like, what? And it was just such a, so, you know, when I was telling you earlier about, do you meet people for a reason, a season or a lifetime? That's, I met him for that reason, you know, and I worked with him for a couple of months afterwards, but that was the reason why he taught me a couple of things about really being an educator. And it was just like, and that lesson was so quick. It's like, wow. It's not about you, it's about the student. I'm like, oh yeah, of course it is. But it totally counterintuitive.
It's a great point to end this particular program with. Thank you so much, Denis. Claire, we do it the French way, professor. Thank you for sharing your wisdoms with our global audience. In closing, you've been listening to the international podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, sponsored by PDF, the Professional Development Forum. PDF provides webinars, social media discussions, podcasts, and parties. And best of all, it's all for free. For more information, please visit professionaldevelopmentforum.org. Our guest today is Denis Leclerc, a professor of cross-cultural communications and global negotiations, sharing his global lessons it took him 50 years to learn. And to our audience, don't forget to leave us a review or a comment. You can also email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That is podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Go ahead and subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And remember, this is a podcast that makes the world wiser and wiser, podcast by podcast, lesson by lesson. Merci beaucoup et au revoir. Thank you and stay safe.
Thank you. Au revoir.